to confidants, he whispered of spirit visitors. The Jews became the enemy within the gates. The Japanese ambassador to Germany, noting how well the, quote, enemy within, end quote, worked upon the German people, is said to have commented, quote, "I wish we had some Jews in Japan," end quote. The 1938 gun laws disarmed the German people. The Nazis were also masters of propaganda. The same scenario is presenting again, ladies and gentlemen. The ancient mystery religion has risen like the phoenix and taken wing in the so-called fraternal orders and the New Age movement. President Clinton speaks of an eternal war of the armies of light against the forces of darkness. Hillary was recently discovered performing seances in the White House, where she communicated with Eleanor Roosevelt, her spirit guide. There is also a, quote, new world order, end quote. When the administration wanted an omnibus counterterrorism bill, the World Trade Center in New York City was bombed. The terrorists used fertilizer and a Ryder rental truck, which seems to be the rental agency preferred by terrorists. It was later revealed during their trial that they were working for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. This whole group had been, in fact, brought into the United States and nurtured by the Central Intelligence Agency. The FBI, it came out in the records of the trial, taught them how to make the bomb. The FBI taught them how to drive the truck. And when the culprits wanted to substitute inert ingredients so as not to injure or kill anyone, the Federal Bureau of Investigation denied their request and insisted they use the real thing. The FBI, in their usual thorough fashion, ladies and gentlemen, recorded everything on tape. It was introduced at the trial, and a transcript was printed verbatim in the New York Times. The judge, however, threw the tapes out and would not allow them to be presented by the defense as evidence. He ruled that it was okay for the Federal Bureau of Investigation to tape culprits in the act, but not for the culprits to tape the FBI or to use the FBI's tapes in their defense. When the omnibus counterterrorism bill languished in Congress, with no hope of passage, the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City was bombed. Those accused supposedly used a Ryder rental truck and a fertilizer bomb. The president spoke of, quote, "those who have sacrificed," end quote. Isn't it strange that in ancient Rome, those attacked were considered sacrifices for the greater good of the empire? And now we have President Clinton talking about those who have sacrificed? To what was he referring, ladies and gentlemen? A sacrifice is an intentional act. No one in Oklahoma City who was killed or injured in that building, I can assure you, made any intentional sacrifice. So, as William Jefferson Clinton made a Freudian slip here, well, we believe that he has, because we believe that it was, in fact, just as has been accomplished by the Machiavellian leaders and manipulators and deceivers over the centuries, performed these same acts in history, we believe that this, again, was an effort at social engineering on a massive scale. A year of lies and propaganda followed, along with gun control legislation on a massive scale. And it has been discovered, ladies and gentlemen, that before the bombing, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the same people who murdered the Branch Davidian congregation in Waco, Texas, was performing experiments blowing up trucks in the New Mexico desert with fertilizer bombs. The anti-terrorism legislation passed into law, giving government almost the same powers Cicero sought and that Hitler realized. Once again, a republic is moving to oligarchy and then to dictatorship. And the American people, as the Romans, as the Germans, and as many more that I have not cited here due to time limitations, haven't got a clue. Now, Michelle Marie Moore didn't just write about this nightmare. She experienced it. She lived it. And that fact will quickly become obvious to the reader. She takes us upon a journey that we will never forget. She entangles the web and guides us through wave after wave of horror and deception, all the while never failing to deliver the truth. And as the director of the intelligence service of the Second Continental Army of the Republic Militia, I know all that is included in this book and much, much more. Much, much more. But even so, I find myself unable to leave it. I read and reread incessantly. Michelle Marie Moore is a natural writer with a gift. And that gift is something that we must all make use of. You see, she not only just sat down and wrote a book, she documented everything. She took all of the research of all of the intelligence service members, testimony of witnesses, videotape taken on scene by many different news service agencies, local television affiliates. She rounded up and obtained copies of audio tapes. She has interviewed or accepted the transcripts of interviews taken by intelligence service members, of witnesses and victims' families, of police officers and firemen, and government personnel. And she has put it all down in 640 pages. It is an encyclopedic work. It is extensively indexed. It has a complete bibliography and a very large appendix of documentation, sources, testimony, etc. This is not speculation, what you will read in Oklahoma City Day One. It is not speculation what you're going to hear on this broadcast today and tomorrow and maybe the following day. It is fact. It is fact not backed up by what one person says or two people says. Everything in this book, everything in our investigation, to be considered to be true, ladies and gentlemen, had to be obtained from two or more different sources who did not know of or communicate with the other. And that is the only way, in our estimation, to run a proper investigation of this type. In order to maintain credibility, and of course, the very primary objective, deliver the truth to the American people. Ladies and gentlemen, the hour of the time is brought to you by Swiss America Trading. who specializes in hard assets, non-confiscatable, non-reportable hard assets, real money. Real money. Now, I know for a fact, and this may upset some of you, but it's true, most of you listening haven't got the slightest idea what I'm talking about when I say real money. You conjure up in your mind a picture of a Federal Reserve note, and you really honestly believe that that's real money. There's nothing backing it, except if you call Congress or if you call the United States Treasury Department or anybody else in government, some of them may give you an answer. Others will tell you that they don't know and they have to look it up, and they may call you back and they may not, or they may send you a letter, or you may never hear from them again, which is usually the case. But those that will answer your question will tell you that the Federal Reserve note is backed up by the full faith and credit of the United States government, which just is another way of shining you on and telling you that you're a stupid fool and that they know it. Because money, by definition, must be, if you read the Constitution and if you read the law, gold or silver coin. In fact, a dollar is nothing but a unit of measurement. A dollar is not money, ladies and gentlemen. A dollar is no more money than a quart is milk. Do you understand that comparison? A dollar represents a specific weight and measurement of purity of silver coin, which when you have that met under the law is $1. The law says that it can also be an equivalent value in gold coin. The Constitution gives Congress the power to coin money, not print money, not farm money out to the Federal Reserve to create with a bookkeeping entry or by issuing credit. You see, because that's creating wealth out of thin air. When you can create wealth out of thin air and loan it to someone using their property as collateral, in other words, what they think that they have earned with the sweat of their brow, and then you confiscate that when they cannot make the payments, you have stolen that property. In fact, the whole proposition is a fraud. What you have in your pockets called Federal Reserve notes, number one, is not federal. Number two, it is not a note. And if you don't believe me, get a law dictionary. Black's Law Dictionary is the most readily available and the most widely accepted that I can recommend. Look it up. The Federal Reserve is no more federal than federal dry cleaners is. You see, when you see that word federal, you automatically think that it belongs to the government. It does not. It is a private corporation. And a note, ladies and gentlemen, is a contract that is a representation that somebody owes somebody else something. The note must specify what is owed, to whom it is owed, and by whom it is owed, when it must be paid, and how, and to whom. So when you look on there and you see $1, that's the first lie, it's not a dollar. When you see Federal Reserve, that's a second lie. It's not federal at all. That name was chosen to fool you. When you see note, that's another lie. And I could go on because there's several more on the face of those counterfeit bills. You need to get your hands on some real money, because sooner or later this house of cards is going to come tumbling down. And when it does, if you don't have real money or something of real value that you really own, you're going to find yourself in a ditch, homeless, hungry, and sick. Call 1-800-289-2646 and do it right now, ladies and gentlemen. 1-800-289-2646. Ask them for the current newsletter. Tell them that you're a steady listener to The Hour of the Time with William Cooper, and you'll get red carpet treatment, I guarantee it. Tell them you'd like to explore the possibilities of getting your hands on some real money, and do it now. 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad that you did. And if it's easier to remember, 1-800-BUY-COIN. human blood is heavy. The man that has shed it cannot run away. Those words, at first they had been nothing more than a quietly passing thought, the barely discernible voicing of an ancient proverb. Initially, they had served as the dismal acceptance of the overwhelming events of that day, an acknowledgement of the evil that had come upon us. But now the day was over, long over. Hours before midnight had come and gone. A chill had settled and the air was unnaturally damp and oppressive. The sticky heat of the afternoon had been swept away by a sharp, bone-chilling northern blast that rushed through the city shortly before sunset, bringing unwanted rain and high winds, threatening clouds hanging low and thick in the southwest, and distant lightning had warned of continued gloom. The whole world seemed to shudder that night, but how could you avoid it? After all, human blood is heavy. That night should have been the first vibrant blush of wild prairie spring, Oklahoma April. It should have been a time both tranquil and fragrant with the scent of newly blooming iris and daffodils, a peaceful hour that should have carried the fragile perfume of honeysuckle on the prevailing southern breeze. It should have been a night for throwing open the windows after the bundling of winter and drifting sleepily into the late hours on thoughts of starlight and beauty. But you see, human blood is heavy. It had been 18 hours since the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City had exploded in an instant of carefully orchestrated horror and terror. Already it was evident that deceptions, deliberately and meticulously rehearsed, were being given their first performances for an unsuspecting, shocked, and numbed audience. Already a multitude of contradictions had been revealed, altered, denied, and disguised. Already a quickly manufactured blanket of disinformation had been thrown over the disaster by players who did not even realize they were performing in the drama. And from some inner place of spiritual strength and personal conviction, I knew that this situation could not be allowed to stand unchallenged. Human blood is heavy. The man that has shed it cannot run away. Those words. Throughout the day, those words had increased in intensity and fervor in my mind, and just then, in that cold darkness between days, I was hearing them at full volume. No longer were they merely the miserable acquiescence of helplessness in the face of so great a trauma and disaster. No longer were they the impotent sigh of hope against hope that someday someone might solve the mystery of who was responsible for these multiple acts of wanton murder. No longer was I content to remain silent and motionless while my homeland became the sacrificial altar and my countrymen the hapless victims in a highly ritualized political execution. Those words had become my force of will. There was no contemplative silence that night. For many hours, the atmosphere of my home had been a confused jumble of sounds. Television, local radio, police scanner reports, and shortwave broadcasts were all simultaneously transmitting the news of the same event. Every available audio cassette deck was in use. Every boombox was recording a different local radio station, isolated in a closed bedroom or closet. The video recorder was rolling tape, preserving information from different visual news sources. The fax machine was in operation. The computer word processor was never far from my fingertips, and always there was the ringing telephone, even into that late and desperate hour. At that moment, exhausted and shivering in the unseasonable coldness, belting back yet another cup of coffee, I knew that the possibility of sleep was out of the question. I was not so much sleepy as emotionally drained. My husband and I continued working throughout the night and into the next day, planning for an uncertain future and collecting the initial information that would later assist in the separation of truth from the official story. So much vital and revealing information was broadcast during the first 36 hours after the explosions, information that might consist of nothing more than a passing glance at a significant piece of the rubble of the building, a full face shot that identified an individual walking before the camera who should not have been there, or an unintentionally telling remark made by a witness or an expert. Important audio information was recorded from reports made by eyewitnesses at the scene, much of which would later be vigorously denied by federal officials. Some of that information would vanish completely after the first day, never again to be repeated over the airwaves. In later stages of the investigation, some of the witnesses and journalists who broadcast those reports denied ever making the statements that had been recorded in their own voices. But all of these minute details would have to wait for another day of sorting and careful thought. The important thing at that particular moment was to stay totally focused on the collection of information of local origination. It required intense concentration due to the large number of sources being recorded simultaneously, but more importantly, it required me to be fully conscious, and my eyes were burning with fatigue. I poured another cup of coffee, cut the bitterness with a generous dollop of milk, stretched long and hard in the hope of forcing wakefulness into my bones, and returned to the living room to monitor the course of events. The need to focus inwardly and to grieve was not to be given rein at this time. The intense desire to shut out the noise and withdraw into my own private haven of safety and security could not be indulged. Human blood is heavy, and its weight is a call to service. As a member of the intelligence service of the militia of the Second Continental Army of the Republic, I had a clearly defined duty to perform, the importance of which could not be underestimated. I was sworn upon my sacred oath to gather by any and all legal and lawful means information from all sources, to provide for the free flow of information to the whole of the people, the militia of the several states of the Union. This was my responsibility, and I would perform it to the best of my ability to my last dying breath. While tracking the videotapes, flipping the audio cassettes, and monitoring the police scanner with my husband, I reviewed in my mind the fearsome facts of that first day, April the 19th, 1995. I first heard about the explosions that destroyed the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building while drinking my morning coffee. A friend had telephoned to make certain that my husband was not working in downtown Oklahoma City that Wednesday morning. I assured him that my husband was right there in the house and asked why he was so concerned. It was then that he told me what had happened. Finding himself unable to adequately describe what had occurred or to answer the barrage of questions I asked, he finally, with an odd resignation in his voice, told me to turn on the television for full coverage of the disaster. He said it was the only way I was going to understand. His utterly serious tone and uncharacteristic speechlessness about the details was enough to alarm me. He encouraged us to pray. Before the telephone receiver ever left my hand, I called frantically to my husband and to quickly turn on the television so we could see what was going on. Rushing into the living room to see for myself, I stopped, dead in my tracks at the scene before me. A single glance sent me bounding back to my desk to telephone a report to my commanding officer, William Cooper. I knew it was still quite early in Arizona, where he lived, 2 hours earlier than in Oklahoma. But this was a situation of such magnitude and with so many potentially dangerous consequences that I decided not to wait until a more reasonable hour to break the news. I was shaking as I dialed the number. During my telephone conversation, my husband continued monitoring the television news reports. The telephone in Arizona rang only twice, and Mr. Cooper's wife, Annie, answered. I identified myself, asked for Bill, and told her it was an emergency. In the background, I could hear her urgently rousing him from sleep. Bill took the receiver, and at first sounded a bit groggy, still half asleep. But the instant he knew what had happened, he became fully alert and gave me his undivided attention. I again identified myself, apologizing for calling so early in the morning, and told him I thought he should know what had occurred here. Much like the friend who had first notified me, I suddenly found myself incapable of fully describing the event. I glanced once more at the pictures on the television screen. How could such gut-wrenching information be conveyed? My shocked mind was going into a verbal shutdown, and after a moment of struggling to find any words at all, I blurted out, "Bill, somebody just blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City. The building looks like the whole front of it has been sliced off and a big chunk cut out. A lot of people have been injured and probably many are dead. Just go turn on your TV. Get something on the satellite feed. The coverage is live everywhere." I'm sure I sounded a bit hysterical. I was a bit hysterical. There had been multiple explosions. The video reports of the disaster showed extreme asymmetrical damage. The front of the building, facing north, had been blown outward, and at the far east end, a large rounded section of the interior, which had collapsed vertically upon itself, was now nothing more than a confused pile of rubble, dust, debris, and blood, 2 stories high. At first, there were 2 columns of smoke, one coming from the building, and the other, larger column of black smoke, boiled upward from the parking lot across the street on the north side of Northwest 5th Street, where many automobiles were burning. Several eyewitnesses would later report seeing a mushroom cloud of smoke rising from the building. There was not yet any information about the number of dead or injured. Only frightened and shocked speculations offered by the news media. Firefighters were already on the scene, extinguishing the burning cars and initiating the rescue operation. The streets were filling with the dazed and bloodied walking wounded who staggered out of the rubble of the federal building and the wreckage of other damaged buildings in the area. Friends and relatives of government and civilian workers in the Mura building came running from their offices nearby. Some were crying hysterically as they searched for their loved ones. Others rushed into the dangerously unstable remains of the building and began extracting the wounded from the shattered concrete and twisted metal. Mothers, weeping and screaming for their children buried inside the building's daycare center were clawing at law enforcement officers who held them back from the dangerous wreckage. Medical personnel began pouring into the area, and many unnamed civilian heroes joined the medical, police, and fire rescue workers to save as many of those still living as was humanly possible. The scene on television was graphically tragic and violent, dreadful and compelling. It was This information was streaming into my living room as I made my sketchy report to Cooper. At that moment, nothing conclusive could be relayed other than that the Alfred P. Mura Federal Building in Oklahoma City was quite simply gone. The Alfred P. Mura Federal Building, located at 200 Northwest 5th Street, was originally called the GSA Building and was later named for a circuit court judge of distinguished reputation. Alfred Paul Mura had been born in Johnston County, Oklahoma, on October 27, 1904. The son of George Washington and Nora Simmons Mura, Alfred received his LLB, that's a Bachelor of Laws degree, from the University of Oklahoma in 1927. He became a member of the Oklahoma Bar in 1928 and married Agnes Millam on June 29, 1930. Together they had three children, Ann, Paul, and Sue. During the 1930s, Alfred Mura was active in Democratic Party politics and helped coordinate the Young Democrats organization. With his school buddies, Luther Bohannon and Roy Savage, known together as the Rover Boys, Mura helped engineer the triumphal 1936 United States Senate campaign of Joshua Bryan Lee, his former speech professor at the University of Oklahoma. From 1937 to 1940, Mura served as a United States District Court judge, and in 1940 became a judge for the United States Circuit Court of Appeals, 10th Judicial Circuit, where he served for many years later as chief judge. He earned his Doctor of Law degree from Oklahoma City University in 1954. In 1947, as one of the three judge panel ruling on an appeals case, Mura helped open the doors of Oklahoma University to black students when he ordered that George W. McLaurin, whose law school application had been denied solely on the basis of race, be allowed to attend classes at the Oklahoma University College of Law. Always active in civil rights cases, Mura found himself again working with his longtime school friend, Luther Bohannon, who had become a federal judge in his own right. When the school busing issue came before the courts, it was Judge Bohannon's ruling that changed Oklahoma City public schools from the neighborhood concept and brought about the policy of busing students to achieve integration and racial balance, a decision that remained controversial for decades. Judge Mura, a Methodist, served as a trustee for Southern Methodist University in Texas, and in 1954 received the Distinguished Service Citation from Oklahoma City University and the Hatton W. Summers Award. In his later years, he served as the executive director for the administration office of the Federal Judicial Center in Oklahoma City. Mura was a member of the American Bar Association, the Oklahoma Bar Association, the Order of the Coif, Lambda Chi, Phi Alpha Delta, and was a 32nd degree Freemason of the Southern jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite. Mura passed away in 1975 and is buried in the northwest corner of the Fairlawn Cemetery, located at 2700 North Chartel in Oklahoma City. The building that would eventually bear Mura's name had been designed under the direction of James Loftus and had been a joint architectural venture between the firms of Shaw Associates and Locke, Wright, and Foster. The structural engineer was Ed Kirkpatrick. The building was designed in the late 1960s and early 70s, and the groundbreaking ceremony took place in 1974. Construction, completed in 1977, had taken 18 months and had cost $13.2 million. The building was dedicated the following October. Within the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building were the offices for the following government agencies and departments: the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, known as the BATF, the Defense Department Investigative Service Field Office, known as DIS, the Department of the Army Oklahoma City Recruiting Company Headquarters, the Drug Enforcement Administration, or DEA, the Federal Employees Credit Union, the General Accounting Office, or GAO, the General Services Administration, GSA, the Social Security Administration, the United States Air Force, the U.S. Customs Service, the United States Department of Agriculture, the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, the U.S. Department of Labor, the United States Department of the Treasury Secret Service, the U.S. Government Department of Transportation, Federal Highway Administration, the U.S. Government Office of Health and Human Services, the United States Government Office of Personnel Management, the United States Labor Department Bureau of Apprenticeship and Training, the United States Marine Corps Recruiting Station, and the United States Marine Corps Officer Selection Office, the U.S. Small Business Administration, the Veterans Administration, VA, the offices of several federal judges, and the America's Kids Daycare Center. This is the Voice of Freedom. Thank you. feature presentation of the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network, with studios in Eager, Arizona, broadcasting on satellite GE1, transponder 7, 7.56 audio, and over 700 low-power FM stations across the country and around the world. Listening to the Hour of the Time, ladies and gentlemen, I'm William Cooper. Today, you're listening to a special presentation, a reading from Michelle Marie Moore's book entitled Oklahoma City, Day One. It is 640 pages in length, extensively documented and sourced, contains a large index, an even larger appendix, a complete bibliography, and this book only deals, ladies and gentlemen, with what happened on April the 19th, 1995, and some things that must be explained beyond that date in order to understand the context in which they happened. I'm William Cooper, and you're listening to The Hour of the Time. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like information on how you can purchase a copy of Oklahoma City Day One, please call 520-333-4578 anytime during or after this broadcast, or anytime all day tomorrow, and I will give out the information at the end of this broadcast. The number is 520-333-4578. That's 520-333-4578. Although the Alfred Murrah Federal Building was described by the media as a 9-story structure, it actually had 13 stories, 4 of which were underground and included several levels of underground parking. According to James Loftus, head of the building's design team, 2/3 of its square footage was underground. It had 107,000 square feet of office space, 196,000 square feet of storage, and 11,750 square feet of, quote, special space, end quote, which included bathrooms and a cafeteria, for a total of 315,000 square feet. Originally, the underground parking garage had been built with a 10,000-gallon gasoline reservoir and pump, but fortunately, the reservoir had been filled with sand. Following the explosions, all that remained of the exterior above-ground structure were the shattered east-west and south walls. The north front wall, a curtain wall, constructed primarily of steel-reinforced concrete, glass, and aluminum, had been blown 50 yards to the north, across Northwest 5th Street. The flying rubble had crashed into the south side of the Journal Record Building, falling into a mangled heap piled under the sidewalk and parking lot. In the surrounding properties, the Journal Record Building had been constructed in 1923 by the Masonic Temple Building Association of Oklahoma Lodge No. 36, and for 14 years, its auditorium played host to many illustrious entertainers. The Masons and the India Temple Shrine used the new Masonic Temple as their principal place of business for 7 years until 1930, when both organizations moved to other locations. After the explosions of April 19, 1995, the ornate columns and symbolic temple architecture adorning the east side of the Journal Record Building was all that remained unscathed. The rest of the building, inside and out, was a wreck. Many of the properties in the immediate vicinity of the Murrah Building had originally been owned by the Oklahoma Masonic Lodge No. 36, the India Temple Shrine, the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks, and the Knights of Columbus. For almost 50 years following the Oklahoma land run of 1889, these four organizations had leased, borrowed, bought, and traded the properties among themselves. Most of those fraternal organizations lost their downtown property holdings during the Great Depression of the 1930s. These properties included land on which would eventually be built the Marriott Convention Center, the Bank First Building, the Wright Building, the Kerr McGee Complex, the Cal Cord Building, the Internal Revenue Service Office Complex, the Federal Courthouse Building, the Oklahoma Natural Gas Building, the Oklahoma City Hall, the Manny Building, the YMCA Parking Annex, Liberty Bank Tower, Tri-Gen of Oklahoma, the White Temple, the Journal Record Building, and the Murrah Building. In November 1995, as federal prosecutors were preparing the Oklahoma City bombing case, it was discovered that the Murrah Building had been built upon a piece of property known as Block 39. Much mystery still surrounds the property, and as of this writing, the issue has not yet been resolved. It seems that the Murrah Building itself was owned by the federal government. However, there was no documentation in any of the real estate records that indicated that the government had ever taken possession of the land upon which the building stood. In the absence of that vital possession document, it was ruled that both the federal and local governments had concurrent jurisdiction in the case against the men accused of the bombing, and thus murder charges could be brought against the suspects at every court level. Across the street from the Journal Record Building, the entire side of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building was severely damaged, but the west end was not as structurally devastated as the east end. The outer measurements of the building were approximately 70 feet deep, north to south, by 200 feet long, east to west. In only four portions of the building's interior did the support columns remain standing. And that was in a section at the west end that measured approximately 70 feet north to south by 40 feet east to west. This was the single largest interior area still standing. Another portion to the east of that section, a middle section of the interior, remained that was approximately 35 feet north to south by 60 feet east to west, a section of equal size, which comprised the entire north half of the building, had been blown outward at this location. To the east of the middle section, a portion of the building, approximately 60 feet by 60 feet, had been gouged out of the structure, leaving only 10 feet of flooring material still attached to the south wall. The very small southeast corner section remained standing, measuring approximately 50 feet north to south by 20 feet east to west. The interior of the building was completely, totally gutted. As I spoke to Bill Cooper on the telephone the morning of April 19th, I could hear Oklahoma City Mayor Ron Norick on the television reporting to the media that there had been an estimated 590 workers and possibly another 400 citizens conducting morning business in the building at the time of the explosions. We were suddenly faced with the first speculation of the day that there might have been almost 1,000 people in the Mira building when the explosions occurred. The information being reported was so horrific as to be unbelievable. This sort of event happened in places like Beirut, Lima, Bogota, or New York City, anywhere but here. Like everyone else, I felt totally out of my element. This could not have happened in Oklahoma, in my state, in my city. I felt myself hovering near panic. Thousands of possible imminent scenarios were passing through my mind. It seemed to me a foregone conclusion that before the day was over, martial law would be declared. What would that mean in the practical reality of daily living? Having no information yet about possible suspects, but knowing that escalating terrorism and inner-city violence had long been used to manipulate the American people politically, the immediate future looked very bleak indeed. I was uncertain what plan of action to take in response to the bombing, and that indecisiveness had a paralyzing effect upon my thinking. Cooper calmly took matters in hand and brought some focus to the situation. I was instructed to try to find out what was going on. That sounded simple enough, and I thought my husband and I would be able to assemble some kind of a report on the situation before the day was through. I told Bill we would do our best, and I would get back to him late in the afternoon. But as the day progressed, my husband and I discovered that it was going to be a far more complex assignment than we could have ever imagine. As Cooper and I conversed, my husband reported that former Oklahoma Congressman Dave McCurdy was speaking via telephone to KWTV Channel 9 news anchors Kelly Ogle and Jennifer Reynolds. Although the bombing had just occurred, McCurdy was already certain that Islamic fundamentalists were the parties responsible for the tragedy. McCurdy stated that there was a, quote, false sense of security in the heartland, end quote, that made it more vulnerable to terrorist attack. He further remarked that a lax security environment existed in places like Oklahoma City, and that terrorists operated more freely in that environment. Using his position as former chairman of the House Intelligence Committee as his foundation for expertise, McCurdy said he was aware that extreme radical supporters of terrorism in the Middle East had spoken to groups in Oklahoma City and stated that he believed that Islamic fundamentalist involvement was a very real possibility. Now, having just impugned those of Middle Eastern descent, specifically and Muslims generally, without any evidence whatsoever of their participation in this disaster, McCurdy further speculated that the bombing might otherwise have been the work of, quote, some extreme right-wing militant anti-government, end quote, group. His reasoning centered on the fact that Wednesday, April the 19th, was the second anniversary of the government raid on the Branch Davidian Church in Waco, Texas. Dave McCurdy was not the only official personage offering public speculation and innuendo. United States Congresswoman Eliana Ross Lehtinen from Miami, Florida, told the press that she had notified the FBI of testimony before her subcommittee in Washington. She stated that Stephen Emerson, who had produced the PBS documentary entitled Jihad in America, had described witnessing a meeting in Oklahoma City attended by 3,000, quote, Islamic fundamentalists, end quote. According to Lehtinen's press conference, Emerson had testified that a militant Islamic leader based in Pakistan, Kamal Kelbawi, had addressed the group saying, and I quote, O brothers, the Palestine cause is not a conflict of borders and land only. It is not even a conflict over human ideology and not over peace. Rather, it is an absolute clash of civilizations between truth and falsehood, between two conducts, one satanic, headed by Jews and their conspirators, and the other religious, carried by Hamas, the Islamic people in general, and the Islamic movement in particular, end quote. Emerson's PBS special had aired on educational television in November 1994. This third-hand information, in tandem with Dave McCurdy's second-hand information, was used by the media to fuel anti-Islamic sentiment that would endanger the lives of respectable citizens and result in at least one death in the Islamic community before the madness changed direction and fingers began pointing at other bombing suspects. A warning light went off in my head as I felt the wheels of the national propaganda machine beginning to roll into motion. It was going to be a day of rumor and speculation, and it would be critical to keep track of what was said, when it was said, by whom, to whom, and to what it was responding. One thing was certain. The Middle East rumors were originating with the Washington bureaucrats. Later reports of Middle Eastern participants were obtained by the news media from eyewitnesses in the downtown area. However, by that time, the government and federal law enforcement agencies had targeted American patriot groups, vigorously denying all of the rumors they had previously encouraged. Additionally, some of the witnesses who had seen men of Middle Eastern appearance in the area of the Mira building on the morning of April 19th stated that they had been threatened and harassed by federal law enforcement agents to keep quiet and say nothing about what they had seen. That persons of Middle Eastern appearance were observed in the area was not surprising. As the evidence began to pile up, it was apparent that these men were deliberately in place and were intended to be seen by the public. It also became clear that they were not acting on the instructions of some Muslim fundamentalist terrorist leader or group, but were under the direction and control of federal agencies who had planned a sting operation for the night of April 18th. That had gone tragically awry. It was also never established that these men, who were meant to be seen, were Middle Eastern nationals. They were probably American citizens of Middle Eastern descent. Bill Cooper had warned me to observe a pattern that would soon emerge. He predicted that Islamic fundamentalists would initially be blamed for the disaster, but that within a few days, charges would be leveled against militia groups in the United States. I filed that information into the back of my mind for future reference. In only 51 hours, Cooper's prediction came to pass, and by that time I fully understood how he could anticipate it so accurately. By then, The disinformation campaign was in full swing. Evidence of a major cover-up by federal authorities was already well documented and obvious to anyone who could break through the mass hysteria produced by the media's bombardment of the public consciousness. It was going to be treacherously difficult to keep one's footing on firm, logical ground in the face of what occurred over the following days. In the meantime, Ms. Lee Evans of KFOR Channel 4 Television received a telephone call at 9:45 a.m. from an unidentified male who claimed to be a member of the Nation of Islam. The caller stated that the Nation of Islam claimed responsibility for the bombing, and that such a thing could happen